Hello, my name is Kayla Verhoeven, and this is part one of the Pantograph for April the 9th, Thursday of 2026, and we're going to start off with the bright side, skateboarding joy in the cards. An ex-pro shop owner and his son, 9 years old, create a skate culture game, Bloomington. What started with a gnarly skateboarding injury has turned into a creative family project, and now a business venture for both a father and his son. About 7 years ago, Jennings Hannah, who was a professional skateboarder, suffered a severe ankle break while riding a handrail at the Venice Beach Skate Park in Los Angeles, which left doctors advising him to stop skating altogether. "Well, that wasn't going to happen," Hannah said. "Skateboarding was my first love." While recovery forced him to take a break from riding, he turned to art and creating characters, designs, and ideas that would eventually be a part of the Crib to Crib Skateboarding Company, which he owns in downtown Bloomington. What he didn't realize was that he would be using the art, with help of his son Quiller, 9 years old, to create their very own card game. The Bright Side highlights uplifting moments across our community. Visit our website to read more and to share your ideas. The Bright Side, where good news lives. The Cribbies is a skating-themed card game that is the subject of a Kickstarter campaign aiming to raise $15,000 to fund manufacturing, and distribution. The idea of creating a game first came up when Quiller made a simple homemade game and showed it to his dad. Together, the two would create a 72-card game built around skate culture, creativity, and strategy. "It's been a really great experience making this game," Quiller said. Cards are divided into categories by point value and skate styles, including manuals, rails, downhills, and verts. Players can then choose between a simple family-style version and a more advanced mode designed to mimic the unpredictability of skateboarding. In the beginner version, players collect card combinations to earn points, similar to games like Go Fish. In the advanced version, players manage hidden invisible cards, strategizing to build the best quote-unquote run before revealing their hand. Quiller has already taken the game on road trips and shared it with family members, but he's been unable to get feedback from his dad in local groups. He's been able to get feedback from his dad and local groups at Red Raccoon Games in downtown Bloomington during its public play testing nights. "I think the play testers were really excited that a 9-year-old was showing them a game that he had created," Jennings said. "We got a lot of valuable feedback, and we were pretty early in the game in the design and at the time. Now, with the game created and most of the kinks ironed out, they are aiming to bring the game to a wider audience. As of Wednesday, the Kickstarter campaign has a total of 18 backers and $1,825 supporting it with 25 days to go. If they fall short, Jennings said they would consider producing a smaller batch locally. "We'd like to go big the first time," he said, "but we'll make it happen one way or another." Beyond traditional game shops, Jennings also sees the potential in skate shops like his own, spaces where the culture behind the game already lives. "Skate shops would be really excited to have more things like games, puzzles, and things that skaters and people are just interested in and interested with skateboarding that can do on the rainy days just to have fun with," he said. For Quiller, seeing others play something he helped create has been especially meaningful. "I feel really proud of how far we've come, and I feel really happy that someone's going to play this game," Quiller said. He hopes the game inspires other people to create something of their own. "Other people can explore this happiness, and maybe someday they can build something or make something, because creativity never dies," Quiller said. "It just keeps growing. You can't unteach it." Visit cribtocrib.com to learn more about the game and to help support the campaign. In other news, AFSCME workers strike at ISU. Building grounds dining staff picket, by Drew Zimmerman, 5 hours ago. In Normal, Illinois State University workers are on strike. Members of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Local 1110, which includes more than 300 employees who work in ISU's buildings, grounds, and dining centers, walked off the job early Wednesday morning after stating earlier in the week that they were prepared to strike. They picketed outside Watterson Towers and CEFCU Arena, where the union said ISU President Andover Tarhall was hosting a VIP breakfast. This strike comes after dozens of negotiation sessions and meetings with a mediator in an attempt to reach a contract agreement. AFSCME Local 1110 workers have been without a new contract since the last one expired in July, and without a pay increase for the last 2 years. This has left most employees making less than living wage standard for a single adult, union officials said. Despite these sessions, the union and university administrations have been unable to reach an agreement. According to a statement from the university, its last, best, and final offer provides all employees in the bargaining Unit 5 guaranteed increases to their base pay over the 5-year term of the contract, with the first 2 increases implemented within the next 12 weeks. All employees in the unit would be paid at or above the median base pay for similar positions in the local marketplace, the university said. ISU officials said they don't believe a strike is in the best interest of employees or the university community, but they respect the rights of the employees represented by Local 1110 to participate. The university is implementing contingency plans and will continue to operate during the strike. We are committed to continuing normal operations to the fullest extent possible, according to the statement issued Tuesday. The day before a planned strike, roughly 100 members and supporters of AFSCME Local 1110 rallied Tuesday at Mulberry Street and College Avenue in Normal to express the frustrations. Some of the biggest conflicts cited by the union are the university's rejection of retroactive pay increases for 2025 and the possible elimination of a long-standing contract provision that ensures union members receive at least the same wage increases as other university employees. Mike Newman, Deputy Director of the statewide AFSCME Council 31, said that no one who works full-time for a public university should be forced to live in poverty. Pay for many employees begins at $16.60 an hour, union leaders have said. This is an institution of higher learning, but what's clear is that the leaders of this university need some education, and we're going to educate them if they need to be schooled, Newman said. We're going to school them because they're going to see what happens to the buildings, the dorms, the cafeterias, and the grounds as a direct result of the university's refusal to treat employees with respect. Andrew Franson, a sophomore history education major at ISU, admitted that he is terrified of joining a picket line and is not in exactly the news he wanted to give his parents who had paid for his education. We have to make it clear to ISU administration, and not just the ISU administration, but this community, that we are standing together, we are stronger than... When we are standing together, we are stronger together, Franson said. Several other supporters, including State Senator Dave Kohler, a Democrat from Peoria, spoke in support of Local 1110 on Tuesday before protesters marched to the front of Hovey Hall, ISU's Administrative Services Building. They chanted, "Tar Hall, you're no good. Pay your workers like you should. And ISU pays poverty wages." Local 1110 members authorized the strike last month by a member vote with 97% approval. In addition to Local 1110, the United Faculty Union of the University of Illinois at Springfield is currently on strike. State Representative Sharon Chung, a Democrat from Bloomington, said what is occurring at these two schools shows Illinois has not been funding universities in an equitable way, which is why supporters came to this rally. As the state approaches the 2027 fiscal year, Chung said some of the new revenue projections reviewed by the Democratic caucus were more favorable than what had some had anticipated. But then again, there's lots of needs right now, and so we're going to have to try and figure out a way we can pay for all these needs, especially with the cuts at the federal level, Chung said. It's going to be a tough 7 weeks here in Springfield. In other political news, the Mideast war. Israel pounds Lebanon, Iran hits neighbors. By Steve Holland, Pariza Hafizi, Alexander Cornwell, and Maya Gebeli. Reuters, 5 hours ago. Washington. Relief over a truce between the United States and Iran gave way on Wednesday to alarm that fighting was still raging across the region, as Israel launched its biggest attacks yet on Lebanon and Iran struck Gulf neighbors' oil facilities. World financial markets rose after U.S. President Donald Trump announced the agreement late Tuesday, 2 hours before a deadline he had set for Iran to open the blockaded Strait of Hormuz or face the destruction of its quote-unquote whole civilization. But even as Israel and the United States paused their attacks on Iran, Israel escalated its parallel war in Lebanon, launching its heaviest strikes yet, sending huge columns of smoke above Beirut as buildings crumpled. Lebanon's health minister said dozens were killed and hundreds wounded. Residents said some of the Israeli strikes came without the usual warnings for civilians to evacuate. Iran's Tasnim news agency cited an unnamed source warning that Iran will withdraw from ceasefire if attacks on Lebanon continue. Long after the ceasefire was meant to take effect, Kuwait, the UAE, and Bahrain all reported fresh Iranian missile and drone strikes, several of which targeted vital oil, power, and desalination infrastructures. Iran also attacked Saudi Arabia's huge east-west pipeline to the Red Sea just hours after the ceasefire was agreed. An industry source told Reuters, the pipeline is the main route by which some oil has been able to bypass the blockaded straits. The top U.S. general said Wednesday that U.S. troops stood ready to resume fighting if Tehran failed to strike a negotiated settlement. We hope that Iran chooses a lasting peace, General Dan Kane, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told a Pentagon news conference. A ceasefire is a pause, and the joint force remains ready if ordered or called upon to resume combat operations with the same speed and precision as we've demonstrated over the last 38 days. Talks in Pakistan. Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif had invited Iranian and U.S. delegations to meet in Islamabad on Friday, and that Iran's president had confirmed that Tehran would attend. With several of Iran's veteran political leaders killed in the war, Iran's delegation is expected to be led by Parliament Speaker and former Revolutionary Guards Commander Mohammad Bakir Qalibaf, with the Foreign Minister Abbas Araki. Trump told the New York Post that in-person talks would happen soon, but said Vice President J.D. Vance might not attend because of security concerns, contradicting media reports that Vance would lead the U.S. delegation. Though both the United States and Iran declared victory, their core disputes remained unresolved, with each striking to competing demands for a deal that could shape the Middle East for generations. The Strait of Hormuz remained shut, a senior Iranian official involved in the discussions told Reuters Tehran could open it on Thursday or Friday ahead of peace talks. Any opening, however, would be conditional on agreement over ceasefire framework that would be limited, with the ships still requiring Iran's permission to pass. In a flurry of online posts, Trump announced new tariffs of 50% on all goods from any country that supplies arms to Iran. He insisted Iran had undergone quote-unquote regime change and that would agree not to enrich uranium, which can be used in nuclear warheads. The United States will, working with Iran, dig up and remove all of the deeply buried nuclear dust, Trump said. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth claimed Washington won a decisive military victory and that Iran's missile program was functionally destroyed. Establishment survives. Crowds took the streets of Iran overnight to celebrate, waving Iranian flags and burning those of the United States and Israel. But there was also wariness that a deal would not hold. Israel will not allow diplomacy to work, and Trump might change his view tomorrow. But at least we can sleep tonight without strikes, Alireza 29, a government employee in Tehran, told Reuters by phone. The war was launched February the 28th by Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who had announced they aimed to prevent Iran from projecting force beyond its borders, end its nuclear programs, and create conditions for Iranians to topple the rulers. So far, Iran retains both its stockpile of near-weapons-grade highly enriched uranium and its ability to hit its neighbors with missiles and drones. The clerical leadership, which faced mass protests months ago, has withstood the superpower onslaught with no sign of internal collapse. Tehran's newly demonstrated ability to cut off Gulf energy supplies through its grip on the strait, despite decades of massive U.S. military investment in the region, could reshape Gulf power dynamics for years. The enemy, in its unjust, illegal, and criminal war against the Iranian nation, has suffered an undeniable, historic, and crushing defeat, Iran's Supreme National Security Council said. Netanyahu's office said Israel supported the decision to suspend the strikes on Iran for 2 weeks, but the agreement is a blow for the Israeli leader, who had repeatedly said he wanted Iran's rulers to fall. Yair Golan, a former Israeli military deputy chief of staff, called the outcome a quote-unquote complete failure that endangered Israel's security. The nuclear program was not destroyed, the ballistic threat remains, and the regime is still intact, and is even emerging from this war stronger, he wrote on social media. In other legal news, a $3.6 million worth of meth is seized and a man is charged by Caitlin Klepek 5 hours ago. Bloomington, a Ukrainian man stopped near Karlok by state police has been accused of trafficking about 100 pounds of methamphetamines worth more than $3.6 million across state lines. Ivan Kachuk, 25, who is a Ukrainian national but has a Madison, Wisconsin address, is charged with the methamphetamine trafficking, a Class X felony, and methamphetamine delivery, a Class X felony. A judge ordered him detained in the McLean County Jail. The defendant, appeared in custody Tuesday afternoon for his initial appearance and detention hearing before Judge Scott Black, who heard arguments from the prosecution and the defense about whether Kachuk could be released. In reading the probable cause statement, Assistant State's Attorney David Fitt said these charges stem from an April 6th traffic stop, which occurred while the defendant was traveling east on Interstate 74 near Karlok. An Illinois State Police trooper pulled over the defendant after determining he was following another vehicle too closely and did not have a front license plate. When completing the citations, the officer engaged in a conversation with Kachuk, who said he had been traveling from Davenport, Iowa, and had been on Interstate 80 since leaving Denver. His job involves transporting luxury vehicles, Assistant Public Defender Matthew Butler said. The trooper noticed Kachuk was talking rapidly, and his story, quote-unquote, kept changing, Fitt said. So he asked the defendant for consent to search his vehicle. Upon opening the trunk, the officer noticed a large black suitcase with a lock on it. Kachuk said, "Yeah, that's my stuff," Fitt said. The defendant told the officer he could not find the key to the suitcase, and the officer could cut the lock. Inside the suitcase were 20 large vacuum-sealed bags containing methamphetamine, the prosecutor noted. The total weight was 99.7 pounds, or 45,226 grams, of the material, and the material field tested as positive for methamphetamines. A conservative street sale value for the methamphetamine was $3,618 Fit said, along with the drugs, a clear plastic backpack, and unknown amount of what Fit described as fake currencies. He did not specify whether the money was counterfeit, and no charges related to the money were filed. In speaking with the police, Kachuk said he has made multiple trips for a supplier called Indiana, whom he met while dropping off a vehicle in Peoria as part of the job. He was on his third trip for the supplier when he was pulled over. Fitt said each trip earned him $10,000, Kachuk told police. In his most recent trip, he picked up a suitcase from Riverside, California, from an associate of Indiana's to bring to Indianapolis, Fitt said. In arguing for his release, Assistant Public Defender Matthew Butler said the defendant did not know what he was transporting or that it was illegal. Butler noted that Kachuk was from Ukraine, holds a college degree from his home country, supports a family there, is employed, and is a Ukrainian military veteran. But the prosecution, disagreed about the defense's contention, noting that the defendant made comments to police that indicated he was aware that what he was doing was illegal. Butler insisted this could be a language barrier, noting English is not good. Kachuk's first language, and that could explain his nervousness around the police when he pulled over. Fitt said, this trafficking potentially deadly substances is one of the most dangerous crimes. You are a cog in a machine that kills people. The judge agreed, finding the amount of drugs being transported was quote-unquote huge and asserted the defendant likely is in the trade solely for the money. Black also said Kachuk's lack of community ties indicates that he would not have a reason to stay in Illinois and abide by his release conditions. Kachuk is scheduled for an arraignment on May the 1st. In other crime and courts news, we have a spotlight. Then a Minoque woman was accused of stealing up to $1 million from an employer by Caitlin Klepek 20 hours ago. Bloomington. A Minoque woman has been released from McLean County custody accused of stealing from her employer. Nicole E. Nesland, 45, is charged with two Class 1 felony counts on theft, one reportedly taking between $500,000 and $1 million, and the second for taking between $100,000 and $500,000. She appeared Thursday afternoon for her initial appearance before Judge Amy McFarland. Probable cause was not provided during her hearing. According to a news release from the Lexington Police Department, an investigation opened in May of 2024 after a local business reported an employee had been stealing money from the business. The name of the business has not been released. Assistant State's Attorney David Fitt did not file a petition to detain Nesland, so the hearing proceeded with release conditions. Nesland, represented by an Assistant Public Defender Stuart Wallace, agreed to the following conditions of pretrial release: no contact with multiple individuals, and no contact with the Lexington business listed as the victim in the case. Nesland is scheduled for a pretrial hearing on April the 30th. How time flies, April the 9th of 2026, 100 years ago. On April the 9th of 1926, Bloomington is to be advertised far and near, away up in the vicinity of Lamont, 100 miles north on the Illini Boulevard, have a great display board, and will be calling the attention to the location of Evergreen City. On this date in April 9th of 1951, 75 years ago, Bloomington's mountain, the Old West Side slag pile, will soon be no more. Already, it has been lowered 55 feet by the Rowe Construction Company. 50 years ago, April 9th, 1976, three Bloomington women, with the ideas for a business venture, have gotten together and with an old house are developing the main event at 1406 North Main. After remodeling, the more than the 50-year-old residence will contain a variety of different shops. 25 years ago, on April the 9th of 2001, the first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers. Dick the Butcher and Henry V's Part 2, Act 5, Scene 2, William Shakespeare's famous line usually elicits groans from lawyers and smiles from just about everyone else. However, Illinois Supreme Court Justice Thomas Kilbride takes it as a compliment. Speaking on April the 8th at Illinois State University's Pre-Law Awards Banquet in Normal, Kilbride told students and his colleagues that practicing law should be a noble profession, not just a way to make money. Shakespeare was trying to make the point that lawyers do stand at the forefront of society, helping us to hold the things together, he said, noting the character he quoted was a rebel seeking to overthrow the government. In other news, the Iran war disrupts U.S. small businesses by May Anderson with the Associated Press 5 hours ago. New York. The Iran war is making life more difficult for small business owners across the country, who are grappling with shipping complications, higher costs, and consumers tightening their grip on their wallets. A shoe designer is struggling to import its shoes from Vietnam. A pistachio grower has millions of dollars worth of pistachio exports sitting in the water. A home landscaper in Kansas City is stockpiling fertilizer as prices skyrocket, and a Chicago electronics store owner is facing pain at the pump. Small business owners say the severe supply chain disruptions during the pandemic were worse, but they fear if the war stretches on for months, it might start to come close. The costs are rising, the routes are changing, and the capacity is tightening. It's all happening at the same time, and that is perfect storms for small businesses, said Brandon Fried, executive director of the Air Forwarders Association, a trade group for U.S. companies that move cargo through the supply chain on all modes of transport. At Nicholas Farms in Hanford, California, a fourth-generation-owned pistachio grower and processor, Chief Operating Officer Jared Lorraine said exports make up about 50% of businesses and that they ship to Europe and China and increasingly the Middle East. The effective closure of the Strait of Hormuz has made it impossible to deliver the pistachios to several clients. When the war started, he estimated about $5 million worth of pistachios left stranded in the water, unable to be delivered to customers in Saudi Arabia, Iran, and the United Arab Emirates. With much of the public attention being focused on oil, which is significant, really, the destruction of the food system is, I think, equally as serious, he said, adding 70% to 80% of food in the Middle East is imported. When the U.S. bombed Iran on February the 28th, Nicholas Farms had about $5 million worth of pistachios on ships that got stranded, Lorraine said. They managed to reroute some of them. One batch was offloaded in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia to be trucked to the UAE. Another two loads were able to make it into a port in Oman after being reloaded into smaller containers in India that could make it into that port, but with $3.5 million are still sitting on the water. A lot has just been in limbo, Lorraine said. It's literally been sitting idle for the last 3 weeks, and we're just saying, okay, what do we do? Matthew Tran is the founder of Brickberry, a footwear-based brand in Los Angeles that makes minimalist, also known as barefoot shoes. The company makes those shoes in Vietnam and ships to customers across the United States, UK, Australia, and Canada. Typically, Tran pays about $3,500 per container shipped out of Vietnam, but that's doubled since the war to about $7,000 as shippers deal with rerouting and higher insurance costs. The lead time for shipping has increased by 3 to 4 weeks. It's kind of a traffic jam, he said about the shipping time. So even though it doesn't seem like it would directly affect me because I'm going from Vietnam to America, it does affect me when there's more congestion. He said supply chain disruptions can get worse during COVID, when everything came to a standstill, but he's still worried about how long the war will last. Thank you for joining me today. My name is Kayla Verhoeven, and I will be reading you part two of the Pantograph here in a little while. And thanks for listening, friends. Have a good day.